This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome to this first event in the Chancellor's Colloquium Distinguished Speaker Series for 2012-2013. This is the fourth season, if you can believe it, because I thought somehow that, well, time goes by really fast. And I wanted to tell you that it's my pleasure, of course, that we have for the fourth season a wonderful program, and we open this program with a wonderful speaker. Very interesting, of course, presentation today and discussion. And as you know, the Chancellor's Colloquium is really an opportunity, provides an opportunity for our community to come together and talk about very important issues that are of concern to public higher education. And we are trying to be very broad in the issues we are discussing because our mission is very broad, our scholarship and education is very broad, specifically on this campus, and it is important for our community to be engaged in those very important discussions. So I would like, in fact, to start the introduction of our speaker and our moderator when we come to the discussion and Q&A, and I would like to ask both of them to join me on stage. So our format this evening will begin with opening remarks by Pauline Yu, entitled The Humanities Without Apology, and then a short discussion with Dean Owens, our Dean of Humanities, Arts and Cultural Studies. And that introduction will be followed by a question and answer period with the audience, and that period will be moderated by Dean Owens. Jessian Owens is Dean of the Division of Humanities, Arts, and Cultural Studies and Professor of Music. She's a very well-known musicologist specializing in Renaissance and early modern music. She's the author of Composers at Work, The Craft of Musical Composition, the first systematic investigation of compositional process in early music. She has held many fellowships, specifically from the American Council of Learned Societies, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Folger Shakespeare Library, and served as president of the American Musicological Society and the Renaissance Society of America. Before coming to UC Davis in 2006, she taught at the Eastman School of Music and Brandeis University, where she served as Dean of Arts and Sciences. She was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2003 and honorary member of the American Musicological Society in 2008. And now I'm honored, truly honored, to introduce our distinguished speaker, Pauline Yu. Pauline Yu has been president of the American Council of Learned Societies since July 2003. Professor Yu's scholarship focuses on classical Chinese poetry, comparative literature, and issues in the humanities. She's the author and editor of a number of books on Chinese poetry and culture and has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the ACLS, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Professor Yu was awarded the William Riley Parker Prize for Best PMLA Article of 2007, and she previously served as Professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures and Dean of Humanities in the College of Letters and Science at the University of California, Los Angeles. We are thrilled, really, that she accepted our invitation to speak this afternoon, and we are very much looking forward to her comments or her remarks and then the discussion we have later. So thank you very much, and again, we appreciate so much having you here today. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go sit down and yeah.
I think this one's, yes, it is. It's working now. Thank you, Chancellor Katie, for that very gracious introduction. I'm honored to be here, and I think that the issues that are framing this whole series, what the university today is facing, could not be more timely or of greater consequence to address. Now, my opening remarks are fairly brief. They fill the span of a TED Talk. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this genre. If you've been to YouTube, you may have seen one of them. The acronym derives from its origin in conferences devoted to technology, entertainment, and design, where short, fast-paced, inspirational talks seek to convey new ideas, riding the crest of waves, transforming not just communication, but social life in general. The brevity and seeming informality of these talks, though they're in fact quite well rehearsed, are meant to signal a departure from the decades, if not centuries, of boredom emanating from a podium. Now, a century ago, there weren't any TED Talks, but there was a TEDy Talk, worthy of recall, that you may have heard of. In the tumultuous election of 1912, when former President Teddy Roosevelt was running as a third-party candidate, he was preparing to speak in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when he was shot by an aspiring assassin. Roosevelt was injured. The bullet penetrated into his chest, but it lacked the force to pierce any vital organ. So he proceeded to deliver his speech, bleeding dramatically, but declaring that he was fit as a bull moose, thus giving a name to his progressive party. What saved Teddy? It turns out the assassin's bullet had been slowed by passing through his eyeglass case, and this is critical, the 50-page text of the talk that he was going to be delivering that was in his suit pocket. Had he planned a TED Talk, he would have perished even before his 10 minutes ran out. Well, I feel fairly safe in this crowd. It's a good thing I don't have a pocket to put my eyeglasses in. I only have a few pages of short talk to protect me. But I do continue to be mindful of history. And this is 2012 now. We celebrate at least two notable sesquicentennials that I think are worth keeping in mind. First, of course, is the issuance of the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation just a week or so ago, 150 years ago. Which marked the beginning of the death of slavery in the United States. And the second, which is probably even more pertinent to our general topic, was that even as slavery began to die, the national constellation of land-grant universities was born. That same year, July 2nd, 1862, President Lincoln signed the Morrill Act, which provided public lands to the several states on the condition that proceeds of the sale of those lands be devoted to establishing public colleges and universities for, quoting from the Act, the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits of and professions in life. I'm going to repeat that with my own emphasis, a liberal and practical education. Now, to be sure, the Act specified that the new institutions would give scope to the agricultural and mechanical arts, but it required also that this emphasis not exclude the classics and other fields. So we thus have, from the 37th Congress, meeting 150 years ago, the affirmation that higher education is a public good, that it is not mere workforce preparation, but education for life, and that such an education should include what we now call the humanities. Sadly, many of today's policymakers in the 112th Congress and elsewhere, seem determined instead to celebrate that anniversary by further reducing public support for colleges and universities and promoting the growth of for-profit institutions. I think it's therefore incumbent on all of us who prize and pursue humanities scholarship to make the case for its enduring value. Advocates for the humanities have often been too shy in making that case. In the early 20th century, one foundation program officer observed that with the quick march of science, philosophy and humanism have gone under a cloud. When they assert themselves, they are prone to do so apologetically, on the ground that they too are or can be scientific.
and much of the subsequent discourse about the humanities by humanists themselves has been consumed by a tone of self-defense, hand-wringing, crisis-mongering, and invidious comparison to other fields. I think we should not apologize and we should not self-marginalize. We can and must state clearly and concisely that the humanities are an essential element of our academic and cultural infrastructure. They have always been integral to the university's role as a knowledge-bearing institution, as an incubator of innovation, and as an essential repository of intellectual freedom. Scholarship in the humanities is extraordinarily vibrant. How do I know? The evidence cascades into the ACLS offices, or more precisely, into our computer servers every year. Our annual competitions for fellowships and grants receive more than 3,000 applications and 11,000 letters of reference for the more than 350 awards that we make, carrying a total of $15 million. Our intensive peer review process mobilizes the essentially voluntary contributions of nearly 700 scholars. And if some of you are here today, I thank you on behalf of everybody. I serve as a reviewer myself in two of the competitions and can confirm that this is hard work indeed, but work that leaves absolutely no doubt about the quality of humanities scholarship today. The importance of the questions posed in proposals, the acuity of the arguments made, the impressive range of the evidence already marshaled, and the expressiveness with which conclusions are presented all provide stunning evidence of the cumulative progress of humanities scholarship. At one recent ACLS board member, a member who won an ACLS grant in the 1970s and also served as a reviewer in a recent competition, commented both happily and a bit ruefully that his proposal wouldn't stand a chance of being approved today. I'm pleased to note that applicants from UC Davis have been conspicuously successful in ACLS competitions. Here, if you're sending a proposal in from Davis, you have a 1 out of 8 chance of receiving an award from ACLS, while the average national success rate has been 1 out of 15 or 16. I don't know what the magic potion here is, but it's working. Faculty and students here have been awarded over $1.7 million from ACLS, and 80% of that has come since the year 2000, which is another interesting fact. UC Davis fellows have been especially prominent among winners of our prized Burkhardt and Rice Camp fellowships, which are awarded in very stringent competitions among younger scholars. Their achievements help us make the case for the vitality of the humanities. If we are to give the infrastructure of intellectual innovation in the humanities both the attention and the resources it requires, I think there are several points that we must drive home, and I will just make 5 today. First, it cannot be asserted strongly enough that the humanities are research fields. They're not simply compendia of received wisdom or a refined taste acquired through extended connoisseurship. The simple proposition is obvious to many in this room, but is easily submerged because the practice of humanities research is often individualistic, and the results are likely to be presented in a form that does not explicitly recapitulate the process of discovery and research as a standard practice in the natural and social sciences. But everything we value about the humanities, the knowledge they convey, the insights they provoke, the understandings they sustain, derives ultimately from the hard work of skilled and dedicated researchers. This work requires advanced expertise, exacting methods, and authoritative standards. Without it, our rich past would be opaque to us. As the historian Anthony Grafton of Princeton has pointed out, the rigorous methods and standards of the humanities give them a critical role in preserving the cultural heritage of the nation and world, preserving languages, preserving skill in the authentication and interpretation of works of art, preserving long-form, demanding, expository writing. Of course, all of these areas also produce innovations, new pedagogies for classical languages, such as Arabic, Chinese, Greek, and Latin, for example, as well as for the whole range of modern languages. But there are central humanistic skills, traditional in nature, such as the editing and interpretation of difficult texts in little-known languages, which American universities have fostered and preserved. My second point is a corollary to the first. Humanities research constantly renews itself, asking questions again that were thought to have been answered definitively, and transforming how we see the world around us. That transformation is consequential, and I'll just give you one sesquicentennial example since we're on the theme of birthdays. In the past 50 years, a burgeoning of scholarship on race in America has revised significantly how we understand the Civil War. As Harvard President Drew Faust pointed out in her recent Jefferson lecture, commemorations of the war's centennial in the 1960s looked back to a war between the states, which was portrayed primarily as a clash of industrial and agricultural civilizations. Today, we understand that racial slavery was the root cause of the irrepressible conflict, and that African Americans were critical agents of their own emancipation. Research tests old ideas and creates new ones. Without the renewal provided by research, the public humanities and the humanities in the curriculum would quickly wither away. And I don't need to tell you that a distinctive feature of humanities research and almost all new knowledge produced by it is that it's largely a public good, yielding little commercial gain to its creators. While the printed or digital presentation of new knowledge can be copyrighted, the knowledge itself cannot be patented or sold. Any investor in humanities research is investing on behalf of the public. Point three, humanities research catalyzes teaching. Just as students who directly engage with faculty have better educational outcomes, faculty who directly engage with what they teach provide a better education. Over the past 150 years, American higher education has grown in scope and expanded in power because individual faculty in the system assumed the dual role of scholar and teacher. Scholar teachers whose intellectual horizons are broadened by research are best able to educate students in the liberal arts, expanding their intellectual horizons and instilling in them the same habits of lifelong critical inquiry that they practice themselves. I think one of the best examples of this power is recounted by Andrew DelBanco in his recent terrific book, College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be, and involves the Columbia art historian Meyer Shapiro. Evidently, when Professor Shapiro lectured on the French painter Cézanne in his classes, students were said to have, are supposed to have said, whatever he's smoking, I'll have some. Point four, the humanities undergird democracy. Luc Menand, a professor of English at Harvard and staff writer at The New Yorker, maintains that the academic's job in a free society is to serve the public culture by asking the public the questions the public does not want to ask, by investigating the subjects it cannot or will not investigate, by accommodating the voices it fails or refuses to accommodate. Academics need to look to the world to see what kind of teaching and thinking needs to be done and how they might better organize themselves to do it. But they need to ignore the world's insistence that they reproduce its self-image. The question Menand refers to are, I would argue, precisely those posed by the humanities. Democracy is grounded in the ability to ask them, to be able to evaluate critically the answers to them, to be able to tell the difference between an argument supported by evidence and an opinion. My fifth point has to do with the crucial role that the humanities provide in helping us to understand the world we inhabit. It is the humanists' insistence on local knowledge, on regional knowledge, that can help us to focus and clarify the vision of an otherwise quite monocular globalizing lens. Since the tragedies of September 11th, we've frequently heard the phrase, now more than ever, used to advocate the need, for example, for a sustained study of critical languages and cultures other than our own. But I think the imperative has always been there to do so, as well as our central role in the humanities to fulfill it. I've often quoted the sociologist Nancy Ruther, who said that higher education is an aquifer, not a spigot. Colleges and universities, she argues, cannot be built in response to immediate needs as a spigot someone can turn on for the expertise they need at the moment, but should be conceived as a deep reserve built up slowly and sustained over the long term on the assumption that though specific needs will arise, they cannot be anticipated. Global education takes time and commitment. Deep knowledge of particular parts of the world cannot be reproduced overnight, or produced overnight, for that matter, as Mary Louise Pratt, the former president of the Modern Language Association, has written. It has to be built up over years, supported through real relationships with people and institutions abroad, passed along, invested in, and valued independent of the contingencies, fears, and passions of a moment. And that is why no understanding of a globalizing world can be achieved without a sustained commitment to humanistic study. ACLS has documented the changes in the landscape of the humanities over the last 30 years through the Charles Homer Haskins Prize lectures delivered at our annual meeting each spring. And if you aren't familiar with them, I urge you to take a look at them. They're all available on our website at acls.org. And they really do give you a good sense of who the real stars in the humanities have been for the past three decades. Every year, delegates from our learned societies select a distinguished senior scholar to deliver the lecture, asking him or her to reflect on a lifetime of work as a scholar, on the motives, the chance determinations, the satisfactions and the dissatisfactions of the life of learning, and to explore through one's own life the larger institutional life of scholarship. The resulting intellectual autobiographies, and one lecturer referred to his rather wryly as an auto-obituary, collectively limb the changing intellectual landscape of the humanities, both in its slow evolutions and its sometimes tectonic shifts. In what brief time remains, I can only cite one example, but I think it's a telling one, that of Clifford Geertz, who died in 2006 and was perhaps the best known and widest read anthropologist of his generation. In his Haskins lecture of 1999, he recounts how he came to rework the very concept of culture itself. When Geertz began his fieldwork in Indonesia, anthropologists saw culture as a diffuse and all-embracing, all-seasons explanation for anything human beings might conceive to do, contrive to do, imagine, say, be, or believe. It was a superorganic force that shapes our lives as a cake mold shapes a cake, or gravity our movements. But as Geertz participated in the life of a Balinese village during his dissertation fieldwork, he found that this rigid, free-floating concept could not help him in understanding his new neighbors or in discovering who they think they are, what they think they are doing, or into what end they think they are doing it. To achieve that insight, it was necessary, he concluded, to gain a working familiarity with the frames of meaning within which people enact their lives. Using conceptual tools drawn from philosophy, linguistics, semiotics, history, psychology, sociology, and the cognitive sciences, as well as to some degree in biology and literature. This focus on meaning and meaning-making helped him see his neighbors as active agents in creating their own life experiences, not as automatons playing out a predetermined script. Geertz's powerful new conceptualization not only moved symbolic anthropology to the center of intellectual life, but also highlights how the central object of all the humanities, understanding how humans create and express meaning. Today, as we consider the issues facing the American university, I think it's worth viewing our situation from a global perspective. Indeed, the rest of the world has recognized the manifest strengths of American higher education, chief among which is its historical commitment to the liberal arts and to the humanities, even as current fiscal stringencies are pressing hard upon it. That the U.S. system is really at its apogee throughout the rest of the world in its influence, while increasingly undervalued at home, is ironic to say the least. Even as public disinvestment in higher education continues apace here, many national educational systems are converging on American models. Observers in the United States have witnessed the astonishing expansion and ambition of higher education throughout the world, especially in Asia, what's been referred to as a gathering storm, with a raft of mixed feelings. But we would do well to observe how others have come to value what we are now putting at risk. Richard Levin, president of Yale University, has documented in a recent article what he terms the rise of Asia's universities. The governments of China, India, Singapore, and South Korea, he reports, understand that world-class universities are the ideal place to educate students for careers in science, industry, government, and civil society. creating people who have the intellectual breadth and critical thinking skills to solve problems, to innovate, and to lead. Scientists, engineers, and corporate leaders here have pointed to this Asian university boom and warned of the gathering storm of economic and educational competition in which those nations will dwarf American educational capacities and, by extension, economic innovation and productivity. But President Levin noted a somewhat different dynamic. While U.S. and British politicians worry that Asia, and China in particular, is training more scientists and engineers than the West, he writes, the Chinese and others in Asia are worrying that their students lack the independence and creativity necessary for their country's long-term economic growth. They fear that specialization makes their graduates narrow, and that traditional Asian pedagogy makes them unimaginative. Officials in China, Singapore, and South Korea have become increasingly attracted to the American model of undergraduate education, a model of multidisciplinary liberal education that includes the humanities. This was the vision of the Morrill Act 150 years ago. I think we should not lose sight of it now. So let me conclude with a final centennial reference, which is drawn from the British statesman Viscount Richard Haldane. In 1912, Viscount Haldane, one of the founders of the London School of Economics and Political Science, published a series of essays entitled Universities and National Life, in which he argues that to maintain the university at a high level is an act of high patriotism on the part of the citizens. For it is in the universities that we see how the soul of a people at its highest mirrors itself. With the university's increasingly global footprint, the correspondence between national ethos and the scholarly community instantiated within it becomes more complicated, but also more dynamic. It becomes all the more necessary that the critical and interpretive power of the humanities lie at the heart of the global university. So what is the value proposition for the humanities? They pursue relentless inquiry into the question of value itself. Human beings seek and create meaning and value in language, literature, art, music, science, and in their very history. Students in the humanities, whether undergraduates in the classroom or senior faculty engaged in research, work constantly to understand, interpret, and question those values. Some may be discomfited that the humanities often unsettle conventional worldviews, but that is how we make progress as a nation, as nations, and in the world. We must assert that case, we can assert that case, and we can do so without apology. Thank you.
Thank you, Pauline. It's wonderful to hear your thoughts on the humanities and some of the challenges that we're all facing. You have a unique role as the leader of one of the most important foundations, organizations to support the humanities, and so you have a perspective that is especially valuable. And I want to begin by shifting the focus a little bit and asking you how you view emerging fields in the humanities and, for example, the digital humanities. It's sometimes hard for fields to come into focus and for universities to understand how to help them flourish, and I wonder what perspective you might have on that from the from ACLS.
That's a good question. I think there is, at this point, no question that the medium with which people are working is a digital one,
right.
That the future of scholarship is going to be produced and disseminated and preserved digitally. It's also true that digital technologies are very useful in understanding the past, and whether it be through databases that have been compiled and now can be analyzed, or texts that have been scanned and that people can now search for, or archaeological evidence that can be analyzed as well. So I think that the digital humanities may become a term that is as obsolete as the print humanities are now. We don't say the print humanities. When we're usually talking about things that are going to appear in printed form, it may be that within our lifetime we won't be talking about the mm-hmm. digital humanities. We'll simply be talking about the humanities and assuming that digital methodologies are central to the practice. This is not to say that I think that print is going to go away and that print publication isn't going to continue. I'm one who believes that the imminent death of the book is something that has been prematurely announced. And that
that's good.
We're likely to keep seeing people. I mean, and just look at your bookshelves and ask if you think that that there is a scarcity mm-hmm. of books at this point. Now there are some challenges that face presses, but that's a different question. But this is not to say that the question of the digital humanities doesn't raise questions about what methodologies people should be favoring. These things are perennial. They're cyclical. Every 10 years or so, ACLS has issued a report on means of scholarly communication, and it's always been to announce that something new has happened. But it seems as though the evolution does sometimes take a while. But what's interesting about the digital humanities is that it reflects the fact that these digital technologies are now everybody's mm-hmm. to use. If you think back 50 years ago, who got to use computers? Mm-hmm. Universities, the military, some few corporations. Now everybody does, mm-hmm. And now I think faculty have to recognize the fact that that students are equally, if not more, comfortable using digital technologies than print technologies. But the digital humanities are, referring to the ability of scholars now to look at texts with these new tools, to ask new questions of texts, to be able to disseminate them in new ways. And we are seeing centers of digital humanities being created at various universities. There are there's a sort of parallel organization of centers of digital humanities that mirrors the consortium of humanities centers and institutes, the CHCI, that brings together the 160 or so humanities centers around the world. I mean, eventually, I think they will all come together. And, I'm sure, I think at Davis here, many of your projects involve digital technologies. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very exciting to me to see that humanists, of whom it has, I think, quite unfairly and incorrectly been said that they are unduly conservative in their approaches to knowledge, are in fact some of the real innovators in the academy and using these technologies to ask new questions of old materials.
Okay, thank you. You've mentioned the centers, and I'd like your thoughts on the changing landscape and infrastructure of the humanities. All sorts of humanities centers with fellowships and learned societies, obviously, and other kinds of structures. Do you have a sense of where all this is going? It seems much more complicated than it once was.
I guess, does anybody, how many people think that there is even an infrastructure in the humanities?
Well,
I think, we are often, it's often invisible to us, but, most obvious probably as faculty and students in the structures of departments at universities, that's what we're most familiar with. But there are many other structures and organizations that actually play a very important role in our research and teaching activities. The Humanities Center which you know, Davis has an excellent example of, is one. It's a wonderful space to bring people together from different departments who are looking at problems across departmental lines that could best be answered by more than one person knocking his head or her head against somebody else's. And so I think these have provided a terrific kind of laboratory for the humanities that is an international phenomenon. The Consortium of Humanities Centers and Institutes has in its membership such centers that really are all over the world, and it meets all over the world as well. These humanities centers are an important space for faculty to conduct their research and scholarly activities. Learned societies are an equally important structure that is outside the university, that is a very important place for people within a particular discipline to gather together to talk about issues of shared concern, to establish the standards of the discipline through the journal, through the papers that are presented at annual conferences and such. These are organizations that survive with three sources of revenue: membership dues, revenues from their journals, and revenues from their annual meetings. And this tripod of support is something that I think the societies themselves are becoming increasingly worried about as the financial stringencies have affected the lives of all of us. I don't need to tell you, you've been president of two learned societies, I think, and there are other presidents of learned societies here in this room, too, and we all know that these are important for the kind of solidary benefits that they provide to us as academics who want to reach out to others in our field. But we also know that they are as fragile as any organization today might be, and yet I think a very important element of our world. They are organizations that depend on essentially voluntary leadership, and people are very busy. But it's interesting because when I talk to presidents of learned societies and ask them if they're concerned about membership, they often say, "Well, yes, we are, and we think it's probably because people are so busy in their own home institutions that they can't participate in the activities of the Learner Society." When I talk to deans of universities and ask them, you know, how are they, you know, what's the citizenship of their faculty like, and then they say, "Well, they're never around. They're all busy working. They're all busy in their learned societies." And so, I mean, I don't know where the faculty are. They're somewhere. Each one thinks that the other one has claimed the allegiance of faculty. But I think the fact is that both do, and but that each individual faculty member's time is limited, and yet clearly we each of these elements of the world in which we function provide very valuable benefits to us.
So I've often tried to suss out why UC Davis seems to do well with ACLS fellowships. And one of the answers, I think, is that we are a relatively new humanities division in some ways, and it's a division built on the premise that we are part of the public mission of this land-grant institution, and we are kind of fearless in trying to figure out a new way of doing the humanities. And I don't know whether that's the right answer or not, but I'm struck by the fact that we do better with ACLS than we do in some more conservative kinds of competitions. And I'm wondering about your role as the leader of ACLS, about how you are helping shape the changes and developments in the humanities through this, through the way you're funding what projects you choose to fund.
Well, on the one hand, I don't want to take any credit for how you are doing. I think this is the UC Davis performance in our competitions is really exceptional. I told you it's about twice as successful as Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia. I mean, it's just really, really quite remarkable. And I personally don't have anything. I mean, these are the judgments of peer reviewers whom we do consider to be the most broad-thinking, enlightened scholars in the country who come together and really thrash through the process of winnowing down a list of awards to the lucky few. I think that it's interesting that you think that ACLS is more forward-thinking, because I think for a long time it had the reputation of being probably more conservative or backward-thinking. But I do think that we have programs that recognize forward-moving developments in the field. We have programs that support the digital humanities, for example, fellowship programs. We have a fellowship program that supports collaborative research in the humanities. That was not a very commonly found opportunity until just a few years ago. So in that sense, our programs, are perhaps, riding the crest of certain waves. But I have to say that in as far as the overall competitions are concerned, it's a judgment of quality made by very smart people in a room who have a lot of things to choose from, and I think you should just take pleasure in that.
Okay. Let me open up the questions to the members of the audience. Margie. Why don't I ask each of you who is going to speak to introduce yourselves.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Margie Ferguson, and I'm in the English department. And I've really enjoyed these Pauline's talk. We knew each other years ago in our youth. She's still young. But I wanted to actually take up just where you left off and also go back to something that Professor Yu said in her talk as an anecdote about someone in a fellowship competition, a judge of a fellowship competition, which was that he or she wouldn't have stood a chance in the 70s, something. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a little bit about the idea of progress in the humanities, because I think almost all of us my age and older look around and say, I wouldn't have gotten a job had I been coming on the market now. We're all aware that things have changed, even though in some ways, statistically, the Modern Language Association shows jobs have been bad. We have been overproducing PhDs in the humanities for the last 30 years. So the perception of decline may not be completely borne out. But I really do wonder about whether we can talk about progress in the sense of humanities scholarship is somehow more rigorous or the evidence is more full or better sifted now than it was 30 years ago. I mean, we're in the business, and certainly you as a classical Chinese scholar are, of saying, well, maybe I'm not as, I don't know as much as someone who died 700 years ago. And I think of the humanities as not only sometimes engaging in progress, but also, and this is something that's hard to explain when we're defending ourselves and or even just conversing with peers, we're engaged in trying to think about recursive time and forgetting, loops in time and mm-hmm. uneven developments across different spaces, mm-hmm. losses in translation, losses of cultural monuments mm-hmm. like the souk in Aleppo this week. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what is the counter narrative to the idea that the new is going to be better than the middle old or the really old.
I obviously don't necessarily believe that the new is definitely better or the very old. I think at the same time that we need to be open to innovation, and so I don't think that those two things are contradictory. I think what my colleague was referring to was, and actually we didn't push him on it. You know, what did he mean by saying he didn't think it would be competitive? And that would have been a good thing to ask. I think part of it was that the amount of, you know, largely a lot of it is through digital, databases that are available to us now. I mean, that you can make an argument with so much more evidence than you used to be able to. If your library can afford to get you that database, this is absolutely true. But if it can, then you can sometimes make assemble that kind of evidence that is going to be all the more persuasive in making your point. Clearly, that doesn't necessarily mean we're smarter. You know, we may know more about some things, but that, you know, does that mean that we're going to have better insights into a text or into a painting? I don't think so. But I used the word progress at the very end, and it's, I should say that the I was alluding to something that was I didn't quote. It was a note that was sent to the ACLS when it met in Washington in the 60s. And it was sent by, it was said, welcome to Washington. We're delighted to host the humanities here. Every advance in the humanities is a vital step in the progress of the nation. And it was signed Richard M. Nixon. So, you know, that's our one. I mean, I'd use progress in quotes, I suppose. But so I think the I think your point is well taken, that this is not a fetishism of the new, but I think to the extent that we have new resources available to us to use, we should use them, and however we can.
Yes. Hello, I'm Grace Rosenquist. I'm from the Department of Neurobiology, Physiology, and Behavior, a scientist. Anyway, I'm interested in the difference in the role of women from, today. I mean, after all, you're both women, compared to 30, 40, 50 years ago.
In the humanities?
In the humanities, yes.
I don't think anybody has ever made a comment about women in the humanities like the one Larry Summers made about women in science. You may be familiar with the comment that the former president of Harvard made about whether there might be some innate challenges that women faced to working in science.
The former president.
I did say former president. I think if you look at the history of the Haskins lectures, you can see that most of the early speakers, these are the speakers in the humanities who are recounting their lifetime of learning. So 30 years ago, figure that somebody was probably 70 or 80 years old, and giving this lecture, that most of the early lecturers of that several generations, probably two generations ago, were all men. But I think the humanities as a set of disciplines have over the years not experienced at all a dearth of women. I think they've been a field that helps the university to make sure that its faculty include more rather than fewer women. In many fields, I think probably the majority of graduate students in the departments are women, which is not to say that the men are an endangered species in the humanities, but the women have played a very prominent role. If we look at the presidents of our learned societies, Jesse Ann, Margie, both are presidents or incoming presidents. I haven't done an official poll, but I think that there are probably more women than men.
Huh.
It's pretty close. In fact, a friend of mine who was running for president of Learned Society saw that his opponent was a woman and figured he wouldn't win.
Hi, thank you for being here. I'm Catherine Burnett from Art History, and I'm also the director of East Asian Studies here. Given that parents are now concerned that their children get jobs mm-hmm. after high school and college graduation, and the big emphasis in K-12 education on math and science to the detriment of the humanities and the arts broadly defined, how can we change the discourse? How can ACLS and universities at large generally change the public discourse and conception of the importance of humanities?
That's a very good question. It's sort of, one that I ask myself every day. I had a great conversation yesterday with a group of undergraduates here at Davis who are honors students from all disciplines, not just the humanities, but social sciences and the sciences. And that was the question that they raised, too. I mean, that the pressures from parents to major in something that is going to guarantee employment after they graduate. And I think there are a couple of parts to the answer to the question. One is that if you look at K through 12, why is the emphasis, is there so much emphasis on science? Well, I think Chancellor Gatte probably knows this better than I do, but I think there you're talking about trying to improve what is a dismal situation in the K through 12 situation, of people that insufficient numbers of people who are really trained in science to able to inspire students to be interested in science at all. So I think that a lot of that is probably remedial to a certain extent in trying to correct a really serious problem. It is also the case, however, that I think I read somewhere that the field in which there are the fewest people who have actually studied the subject in, say, high schools is history. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem, too. I mean, I think, it would be good if we had, people better trained in all disciplines teaching in our high schools, and I'm, that world is one that I really don't feel that I have much to, offer about in the way of commentary because I really haven't focused on the K through 12 world. Although I agree that until it's improved, that we will continue to face problems in our universities. My answer to the question is that, and it's the one I proposed yesterday to the students, is to remember that your college years are the one chance you have to really open your mind to things that you would never have thought you would study before. That it's really, you know, your 4 years here really are giving you an opportunity to learn things that you haven't had before and you probably won't have again until maybe you take a MOOC or something like that. But it's, and that they should open their minds to what is available to them at the university and go with what they, where their passion takes them. To remember that the first job you have after you graduate is not going to be your last. Chances are it's going to be the first of maybe 5 or 6 jobs that you'll have. That the more able you are to be able to, the more able you are to be flexible enough to move between employment opportunities, the better off you will be, and that the broader the education you've had in college, the more your education has included fundamental skills like being able to think critically, being able to express yourself, being able to write, the better prepared you will be for a very uncertain employment situation. And I think these are all around utilitarian skills that are instilled in the humanities and will serve them as well as what might look to be a much more job-focused major. So, it's not everybody is going to respond to it, but I think that it's important. One can also cite, CEO after CEO who says, given a choice between a major in accounting and a major in philosophy, I will take the philosopher because that person understands complexity and can read between the lines, and we need people like that. We need people to be able to look below surface value and look at a balance sheet and say not only what's there, but ask why is that there. I think that's important. And I say the humanities provide that.
Pauline, thank you. This is an incredible, incredibly, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. You're such an eloquent spokesperson for the humanities, and we are so privileged to have had you here at UC Davis speaking with us on such important topics. Thank you, and I invite everyone to continue the conversation outside. There's a reception, but thank you so very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.